Greeting and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forums and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce Jerry Kaplan and Gabe Anders, your speakers for this evening. Jerry Kaplan is widely known as a serial entrepreneur, technical innovator, best-selling author, and futurist. He co-founded four Silicon Valley startups, two of which became publicly traded companies. In the Bay Area, that means he's rich. His 1995 book, Startup, A Silicon Valley Adventure, was named one of the top 10 business books by Business Week. Kaplan has been profiled in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Business Week, Red Herring, and is a frequent public speaker. George Anders is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and contributor at Forbes, and the author of The Rare Find. He is serving as the moderator tonight because the robot broke down. Without further ado, our speakers. Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming. I want to take a moment to get a sense of the mood of the house tonight. So I'm going to ask you a fairly simple three-part question. How many people see robots by and large as a force of progress that's making our life easier? Wow. How many people are alarmed by robots and worry that they're going to make our lives difficult or unbearable? So that's five. How many people aren't sure yet and want to see what we can offer to you? So this is mostly a pro-robot crowd. That's probably because of where we are. I was doing a little reading ahead of time, and I noticed a poll in one of the British tabloids, which is the voice of the man on the street, and they said 63% of people expect that ultimately the world will be run by robots and will be marginalized. Jerry, so I'm going to start by asking you, if you were to be faced with that question, which side would you come down on?
Well, did you say 63%?
63%.
Well, let me mention, these are real facts, real figures. 56% of all traffic on the internet are bots.
Okay.
And 24% of those,
yes,
are impersonating people. So I'm not surprised to hear that over 60% think that robots are going to take over the world.
So in a way, the robots have stuffed the ballot box.
That's correct. They're
doing a lot of the voting already.
Yeah, and there's a good argument that they already have taken over the world. So,
I like that. So yes. You'd mentioned bots. I'm beginning to think Twitter followers is probably the first beachhead.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly true.
Okay.
You can purchase, I think, 10,000 of those for $20, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
I have my figures. Is it 10,000?
5,000.
5,000. Excuse me. My fact-checking expert is back there.
So I want to go back. We're an AI researcher and a student of artificial intelligence.
Yes, I was.
Long before it was a popular field. What did we think robots were going to do back in the 60s, 70s, 80s? What did we get right, and what surprised us? What played out differently than the early researchers might have thought?
Well, certainly back then, when I was just a mere pup, you know a lot of the people who were touting the field, mm-hmm. People like Marvin Minsky and John McCarthy. The main thing they got wrong was the timing. They were perpetually optimistic, over-optimistic to a degree that is almost difficult to conceive, as you're probably aware. People would say, within 5 years, we'll have robots that fill in the blank. And, of course, that didn't occur. So now, today, of course, in 5 years, we'll have robots that will fill in the blank. So mainly what they got wrong was the timing. The other thing that I think they got wrong, and this is a bit of heresy, is that they saw a much stronger relationship between machine intelligence and human intelligence than I think is justified, particularly after the 30 years of research that I've been involved in and the 50 years that the field's been around. I don't think it really makes sense to talk about robots and using the same metrics and the same ideas that we apply to human beings. So I think in that sense, many of the people in the field today have got it wrong, because they have the entire problem of what they're working on and what they're trying to do framed incorrectly.
So give me an example of something that is part of human intelligence that doesn't necessarily yield to a machine intelligence approach.
Well, suppose you were an expert chef. It's very difficult for me to imagine an expert chef that make me a genius at developing new kinds of food. A robot can't taste the food. How are they going to be an expert chef? That's just a single example of all kinds of creative activities and person-to-person human activities that I don't think that machines are likely to be able to accomplish. And even if they did, we wouldn't be interested in watching them do it or have them do it.
So that's a really interesting example. I was at a presentation at the Culinary Institute of America, the good CIA, and they had a researcher from IBM who developed some sort of chef-in-a-box robot that would cull through all of the food you had in your house and go, oh, I've got asparagus, I've got ginger, I've got a little bit of wasabi, and I've got some potatoes. What can I make with that? I don't know anyone who approaches food that way, particularly the middle of the week, and someone had asked the researcher, what about the time where I go, I just had a really terrible day and my boss insulted me and I want something that'll cheer me up? And he goes, we haven't thought about that. Mm-hmm. So yes, I mean, good chefs read the mood of people as well as the ingredient list. And
Absolutely. There's all kinds of human activities that just aren't amenable to the kinds of automation that we're really talking about. On the other hand, the way that you described the robot figuring out what to do dinner, that's exactly what I do. I go scrounge in the refrigerator and see what leftover food there is from the various delivery services that my kids have used to have it delivered. So I'm kind of on the robot side on that one.
Okay. Let's go through jobs. What are a handful of the jobs, particularly the ones you cite in the book, Humans Need Not Apply, that showcase the impact of robots? What are jobs that might not exist 5 to 10 years from now?
Well, let me answer that from a couple of different perspectives very quickly. The first thing is I often get asked this question, well, what kind of jobs won't we have in five? What can AI do? That's a more general version of the same question. Well, the problem is that's a little bit like asking, hey, we've invented this new form of transportation, the truck. Well, what can you ship in a truck? The answer is it's such a general technology and it's going to apply so broadly that it seems misleading even to answer the question in this way, to say, well, you could carry carrots or you could carry televisions. So listing a set of professions, I think, creates a misleading thing. Oh, thank God I wasn't on that list. My job is safe. The probability is your job isn't safe. However, there is some things that can be said about it. The types of jobs that are most at risk in the immediate future really revolve around tasks that have certain characteristics, those that are easily definable about what success means. You know, if you paint a house, you know what it means when the house is completely and correctly painted. Tasks that are repetitive, tasks that involve a well-structured set of activities there where it can maybe applied in a similar way to many, many different examples, like filling out forms or filling out a contract or something like that. Interestingly enough, most of those tasks, one more class that is newly coming under the rubric of what artificial intelligence can attack, are jobs which require sort of simple hand-eye coordination. So like hammering a nail or digging a ditch. This is a whole new class of problems which are now going, in the next 5 to 10 years, are going to be amenable to automation that have not been before. The interesting thing about the question, though, is that most of the kinds of jobs that will be subject to automation by artificial intelligence technology are jobs that are typically done by men. And interestingly enough, so I think mostly male-oriented jobs, and I'm sorry to say that there are many gender-biased jobs that are quite heavily gender-biased, those tend to be the ones where we're going to see the biggest impact of this technology. On the other hand, the jobs that typically or are dominated by women typically are not going to be as subject to automation using the current technologies that are coming down the pike. So, for example, drivers. There are 3 million professional drivers in the United States. They are, I believe, 95% male. And driving is one of the tasks that is likely to succumb to automation. On the other hand, nursing, I think, is 91%, 93%, I forget exactly, female. And that's a much more difficult type of task to the types of things that nurses do, which are in chaotic environments and require good people skills, and that involve a fair amount of variation in the types of activities that they engage in, those are not the kind of jobs that we're going to see go away.
So I've seen talk in Japan that with their demographics being the way they are and having a very old population that has a small number of younger people to support it, that some geriatric care could be taken over by robots. What's your sense of whether that's doable or not?
Well, I know that's a big area of concern in Japan, so they're hoping that robots can take over that work. Most people, at least here in the U.S., find that, what would the word be, odious? Mm. In Japan, they have a different attitude. It's very interesting why, but you didn't ask me that question. So
you can go there.
I can go there. Thank you very much. I got permission. In Japan, they have a different, there's a almost a folk religion called Shintoism, yes. I believe it is. And Shintoism has a very different view of the world than we have here. That's a robot slamming the window, I guess. Which is that every object is imbued with some kind of spirit. In our terminology, it's sort of soul light would be the corresponding thing in our culture. So even objects have some kind of spirit. So when we talk about machines that may care for people, they find that less objectionable in part because they believe that machines have some kind of inherent spirit and therefore deserve some kind of courtesy of our own empathy. But here in the U.S., we definitely don't have that idea. The idea that a machine's going to take care of my mother is abhorrent to me. That's not at all what we would want to have done. Now, the demographic problem in Japan, which you mentioned, is obvious. They have to do something to help these people. But I think if you actually look at the technology that's currently available, to a large degree, it's really not suited for that particular task. So I haven't seen anything, sort of facts on the ground, that would suggest that they're going to be successful in creating robots that can actually meaningfully take care of elderly people. It's just the kind of task that's not easily automated, at least with today's technology.
What did you find when you were researching your book about the role of humanizing robots? I mean, if they're big steel arms with sort of painted industrial colors, does that frighten us? If we paint them in gentler colors and anthropomorphize them a bit, does that lead to a welcoming, or is that really not a factor?
Well, anthropomorphism of machines, I think, is a mistake in most instances, and it leads to all kinds of problems. How many of you guys have seen movies like Ex Machina? Can I get a show of hands? For those people in the radio audience, only about 5,000 out of our 10,000 people in the audience raised their hands. How about the TV show Humans? I only got 4 or 5 hands. Okay. Well, I guess that'll be canceled shortly. Thank you very much for your... the problem is that when you put machines into this form, we have emotional reactions to this an object that looks like a human being. And that means the kinds of emotional reactions we have are probably inappropriate and are not really what we would want if we thought about what we were trying to, what our real relationship with these devices should be. So just as advertising today can be use your desire for status or your desire to be attractive to the opposite sex to sell you products that hurt you, like, you know, cigarettes or fancy cars or whatever it might be, the problem is that in the future we may see these anthropomorphized robots causing us to engage in behaviors which really are not in our interest. So at the core of that, I think the issue is, are you trying to fool somebody with the presentation that you're making? We have evolved to have certain kinds of emotional reactions, to like certain kinds of things that really are not applicable to mechanical devices. And I think we need to be very cautious about imbuing the devices that we create with just these sorts of anthropomorphic characteristics.
So I know when our kids were tiny, we were being offered these talking, wind-up sort of robot-like toys and pets mm-hmm. for our kids, and we tended to shoo them out of the house. We regarded them with suspicion. I always worried I was being small-minded, but I do not see those having taken over toy stores. People still want a firm demarcation between what's a real pet and what's a toy.
I think that's true. On the other hand, you raise a very interesting point. Children engage in play and fantasy, and we do not discourage them from believing in Santa Claus. And it is not harmful to them for some reasons that I don't personally fully understand. So the fact is that you can have little anthropomorphic toys or Barbies or whatever it might be, and somehow they grow out of the potential dangers. It's when you have an adult who places attaches their affection to some kind of mechanical object that's trying to persuade them to do something. That's when I think we're heading in the wrong direction and we're doing the wrong sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. You have a chapter in your book about robot ethics. Talk to me a little bit about where the world of robots and the world of ethics come into conjunction or collision.
Well, it's a very interesting problem. We are developing more autonomous and, I use the term very loosely, intelligent machines in a variety of different functions. One obvious one that most people are aware of, self-driving cars. How many people have had a ride in a self-driving car? Two out of the 10,000 people that are here? This is the beauty of doing this for radio. If they even knew that George and I were sitting here naked, they would be very upset about the whole thing. I completely lost my train of thought. Self-driving cars. Now, you might think it's a wonderful technology, and absolutely it is. But the people who are building them right now are very concerned about a certain class of problem that they are going to be called upon to solve. And these are really fundamental ethical problems, because the cars are going to be put in the position of having to make life and death decisions over who's going to live and who's going to die, and we need to have some kind of ethical framework to imbue into these devices like autonomous vehicles that are going to be very difficult questions for our society to deal with. Imagine your car is going down the street and a child runs into the street chasing a ball. And the only way to avoid that child is to run up on the sidewalk, and there's two elderly people walking down on the sidewalk. What should you do? And you can't stop. Should the car run over the child, or should it run over the people? Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this concept of moral agency, which is covered in my book in detail, but we need to have a computational theory of morality and a computational theory of ethics. And this is now an area of considerable concern and study at various universities. How do you build a moral machine? The other comment I want to make, though, is to understand that the machines themselves do not have to be ethical in the same sense that a human being has to be ethical. They have to be ethical in the sense that they abide by, that they behave ethically, and that they abide by the normal human social conventions that we would expect other people to abide by. So they themselves don't have any internal, subjective, self-guided sense of ethics or morality. On the other hand, we're going to have to give them those, because the truth of the matter is machines are natural psychopaths. They do not have the kinds of empathy for other people. How many psychopaths do we have in the audience tonight? I got three or four. Supposedly, I'm not making, I kid you not, who is it that used to say that on TV? Supposedly 1% of the U.S. population are in fact psychopaths. They meet the clinical definition of psychopaths. And yet, we don't see 1% of the people running around like Hannibal Lecter, you know, eating people or shooting
people. Well, they're overrepresented in two populations. One is prison and the other is CEOs.
That
tends to be where they concentrate.
I suppose that's true. my point is that they may not get why people feel the way they do, the other people, the other 99%, but somehow they manage to suck it up and get along with the rest of us. Well, we've got to figure out a way to get the machines to suck it up and get along with the rest of us. This concept occurs not only for life and death decisions, that's an extreme example, but there's all kinds of social conventions that we abide by that robots simply do not have any natural reason to abide by those same kinds of rules. So when you were, if a robot, you send your robot down to Starbucks to go pick up a coffee or something for you, it should know not to run people off the sidewalk in its rush to get you your coffee. The problem that we have is we're going to need to be able to control when and how machines can act as our agents and what kinds of behavior they may engage in. And just because I can hire somebody to go down to the store and get me a drink at Starbucks doesn't mean that it ought to be appropriate or legal for me to have a machine do that same thing. Should a machine be able to stand in line for me? Should a machine be able to repark my car when it's in a two-hour parking zone? These are all the kinds of very difficult social and ethical questions that we're going to have to face over the next 10 to 20 years as these devices begin to invade our lives.
So I want to offer you a workaround on that, because as you were describing it, I was thinking if we try and come up with a one-size-fits-all solution for society, it's going to be very painful and very stressful.
Right.
Why not have a series of opt-ins, dial-ups that, you know, I can have the kid-friendly car that runs down old people because I've already made that choice, and my aging parents can have the Respect Our Seniors car that makes sure that elderly people don't get jostled, and if some younger folks get sort of, you know, chomped up, that was just the choice they made. And we're each comfortable with it in the same way that soldiers in wartime, some of them will jump on grenades and save the rest of their troop, and some of them won't, and we accept that as an individual choice that can be made. There's not one thing that every soldier must do. So, you know, turn control back to the individual, and our robots behave within accepted boundaries in the way that we think they should.
Well, the problem is they don't, and people will make very bad choices in terms of what they're going to direct the robots to do. These decisions have societal impact, and they're not really things that we want to do on an individual basis. So you may decide not to wear your seatbelt, but we have laws that say you have to wear your seatbelt now, and for very good reasons. Let me go back to the self-driving car, use your example. I don't look forward to a world in which one of the, I look on the sticker on my new car, and it says, this is the gas mileage, and this is how aggressive it's going to be to save your life, how many other people it will kill. I don't want to see that decision. I think we want to make that a collective group decision as to how these types of devices are going to behave, and not something that...
But haven't we already crossed that line by allowing Hummers to be sold? And that essentially pre-selects.
The problem is...
We're already there, Jerry.
The problem isn't buying them, it's driving them. The people are the ones that create that. But we do permit a certain amount of latitude in the way humans are permitted to behave, that we're not going to be very comfortable permitting these kinds of machines to engage in that behavior. Here, let me keep on this subject for a second on the self-driving car. It's one thing, to show you how nuanced and subtle this area is imagine if you own the car, you're not going to buy a car that's going to sacrifice your life to save two pedestrians. I think that most people would think that's not a reasonable thing to do. On the other hand, if we have a collective Uber-like collection of taxis, automated taxis that have no drivers that drive people around, now, and you don't own that car, you feel more, I think I feel more comfortable with the idea that that decision is made by the company or the owners of that car to the fleet or the government in order to minimize the amount of death and carnage that occurs on our highway, even if that is not prioritizing my needs over others. So this is a special case of something I mentioned earlier. We have to be very careful about what kinds of machines we are permitted to allow to act as our agents. And it comes up in all kinds of contexts, and this is a good example of that. The ownership of the vehicle changes our ethical calculus as to what the appropriate thing to do is.
And let's pick a tamer example, which would be self-regulating thermostats. Supply of energy isn't infinite. It brings costs and pollution. Should we have a officially set standard that you cannot cool your house to less than, or on the notion that we don't want energy hogs?
Well, I hadn't thought about that particular question, so I'll have to make up an answer.
Okay.
I think that there are ways to deal with that we would find socially acceptable as opposed to legislating it. The way we do it now largely is by increasing a cost to the person. So the question is, how much do you care about that versus something else? Mm-hmm. So the neighborhoods that you and I live in, out here in California, I know this is going to be broadcast worldwide, so I want to be specific about
and
this.
Into outer space, too.
Into outer space, yeah. Right. Yeah. In 30,000 years on Alpha Centauri,
we will be heard.
We will be heard. I've really lost my... Okay, the thermostat. Where we live, there's a water shortage. And how do we deal with that? We raise the price. You have a certain amount you're allowed, and if you want to use all that water, that's great, but it's going to cost you 10 times as much for the last gallon as it did for the first gallon. Same thing's true of my electric bill. It's the same thing. So there are various free market ways to give us some degree of latitude and yet enforce as groups societal standards. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably an approach which will make sense in this context as well.
So let me try you out on another issue that the book raises, and that's the notion that at some point we can upload our brains, mm-hmm. that our physical identity right now will transform into a digital identity, and I'll be able to, share whatever I have to share with generations to come by being on a thumb drive.
Yeah, and which book are you referring to?
Do you like it? Do you not like it?
Yeah, that's fine. Not to be too technical about this, but it's complete nonsense. The idea that you're going to upload yourself into a machine, it's a staple of science fiction, but what does that really mean? The truth is, I can run through some interesting examples to give you a feel for why that's so ridiculous. But in the interest of time, let me just say that nobody has any idea what that possibly means. We don't understand what human consciousness is, and the idea that you can somehow move it into a machine is so far out there that I think it's certainly meaningless, and it's certainly not something that we need to be worrying about today. If you watch these TV shows and movies, they've got two kinds of robots, those that are conscious and those that aren't conscious, and usually the difference is like the color of the eyes or something. But what could that possibly mean? What does it mean to have a zombie robot versus a sentient robot? We have no idea. And a lot of these ideas that are floating around our culture are really potentially problematic because they lead us to understand problems in ways that are counterproductive and distract us from the real problems that these sorts of devices are going to create for us in the short run and that will be affecting us in the next few decades.
Even though we've got rappers now who exist after life as holograms, you don't think that there's some ability to create an approximation of a person, even if it isn't the entire person?
Well, I don't think it's unreasonable to think in some future environment that you could take a machine and copy, let's say, all of your memories and perhaps something about the way in which you behave into that machine, and it may operate and behave in some ways like you do. But the reaction, if you look at some previous generations, let me go back and look at it this way. Prior to my great-grandparents probably had no memory or idea of the people several generations back. Then they invented photographs. Well, now you had an image. You could capture a certain set of a person's characteristics and put that on your wall. My grandmother, before she died, we did a video of her. Well, that's much better than the photograph. We captured much more of her dynamics, and we have this wonderful video of her, two-hour video of her talking about what her life was like before they had cars. It was really, really interesting. She was quite a character. But suppose we had this box. I like to think of it as grandpa in a box. It sits on your mantelpiece just like those photographs do, and if you want, you can go up and push the button and ask grandpa a question, and every once in a while he'll give you some good advice. But the idea that grandpa in a box is somehow him, that's just preposterous. And if you want to cheat fate and cheat death by thinking you're going to upload yourself into a box, what is it really? It's a machine that copies certain of your behaviors. That's what it is, and it's nothing more than that.
Okay, so you're not going to give them the vote. You're not going to let them vote.
In my next book, and I'm serious, I already wrote this, I talked about that as an example. This is a great example about agency. I'll try to do this in 30 seconds because it's a really interesting example. Imagine you're going out of town and you're a great hacker and programmer, and you're not going to be around during the next election. So you program a machine to vote for you online. There's lots of ways you can, this is coming, you'll be able to mm-hmm. vote online. Nothing wrong with that. That makes sense. You program in your vote. Okay, the next year, you have to go a little earlier and you don't know exactly who's going to be running. So you program in a whole bunch of parameters about what kinds of principles you want the candidate that you want to vote for to abide by. And it places your vote and everything goes great. Then the next year you go away on a trip and you set this thing up so that every year it's going to vote for you according to what you believe are your principles, and you never return. And years go by. Do we feel okay with the idea that this particular program is going to be placing votes on your behalf? Is that something where you can delegate that type of decision to a mechanical device? I think that we become increasingly uncomfortable, and it's a great example of this notion of we're going to have principles over what do we mean when we allow a device to be our agents and to act in our stead.
Nice. If I'm a person starting out my career, what's your take on the impact of artificial intelligence, robotics in the decades to come? What decisions should I make differently, or things should I be planning for because of what you've unearthed in researching the book, which, once again, humans need not apply?
Well, you're asking me to contrast artificial intelligence and natural stupidity? Is that what you're saying? Leaving a little bit aside on artificial intelligence is just a part of a larger issue, which is how do you prepare for your future? Mm-hmm. Something you've written about very thoughtfully.
In the past, yes.
In the near past.
Yes.
the recent past, I guess, is the proper term. The late future, whatever you want to call it. Okay. There's an interesting thing happened to me in the past couple of months, actually. I've got four daughters. One of whom is in the room today, and I'm not going to point her out because she'll get totally embarrassed if I do that, which is so much fun, I'm going to have to do it. Two of those four, you might think the most important day in your life is when your child is born or the day that they go to school or get married. I don't think so. I think it's the day they get their first job because that's when they really become a responsible human being on their own. And as a side effect, they also get off the payroll, which is terrific. Now, two of my four daughters got their first job in the past few months. And the interesting thing about those jobs is that neither of the professions that they are in existed when they entered high school. One of them is a social media consultant doing promotion for restaurants online. And the other one is working at an online educational company. And so neither of those two professions existed. So when things are changing as quickly as they are, and this is something I talk about quite a bit in the book, about the rapid changes and evolution in the workforce and in the job skills that are necessary for that workforce, you can't really today go to school and reliably say, this is what I want to become, and this is what I should do to prepare for that. So I think the concept that makes the most sense is learn how to think critically. Get a general education. Go for that liberal arts degree, because that will serve you best. Those skills are the most general and are going to serve you best in professions that will be arising at an increasingly rapid rate in the near future. And that's you've got to have the skills that are going to be necessary for those new jobs.
That, I think, also plays off your earlier point that if it's a repetitive task that can be bounded by formulas, there's probably a machine that can do it better. If it's an analytical, a judgmental and evaluative task, that's much more likely to play to what humans actually do better.
Correct. Despite what's going on in artificial intelligence, thinking broadly is not one of the characteristics that machines do well. They tend to be very good at very specific tasks, and this notion that machines are becoming more and more intelligent, I think, is miscasting the problem. You might think many of you here are carrying a smartphone, as an example. Well, look at the term, a smartphone. Well, what makes it smart? Well, it can do a lot of interesting things that you would think require, if a human were doing it, would require intelligence. Well, that doesn't mean the phone's intelligent. It just means it can perform those tasks that humans would have to apply intelligence to. Now, what does it mean for the phone? I'm using this as a an exemplar of an artificial intelligence program for a moment. Mm-hmm. What does it mean for the phone to get smarter? Well, you load in more apps, right? The phone can do more things. But do you think that that really means that the phone is more intelligent? I think the answer is no. And in that way, this whole notion, which the idea that artificial intelligence is becoming more general, which is kind of true, or that it's approaching human intelligence, which I think is entirely false, is the wrong way to cast this whole issue of what are we going to do about robots in the future.
If you were running a $100 million venture fund with a mandate to invest in the future of robotics as they apply to human civilization, we'll give you a nice broad charter. What are three or four of the things you'd want to invest in?
Well, first of all, that's an awfully small venture fund, George. That would get me half an investment in some of the things.
We'll up it. The Kuwaiti investment office just gave you another $900 million.
There
up to
you
a billion.
Go. All right. That's right. I don't want to fall out of there. What is it called? The seven-figure club or whatever it was?
The three-comma club.
But I can't count when I can't talk and think at the same time, as this interview demonstrates. So you're asking what are the...
Where would you put money that the market on its own is not doing or is doing insufficiently?
Well, there's some really big opportunities coming up. They're much more mundane than you might think. You have to look at there are two fundamental advances in artificial intelligence that have occurred over the past 10 to 20 years. They've become useful enough that they're going to make their way out of the laboratories and into the real world. The first of those is what I'll just loosely call sensory perception. It's a whole series of things, but it's basically a whole bunch of sensors that can tell what's going on in the real world around you. And when I was talking about hand-eye coordination, the types of jobs that would be subject to automation, that's what I was referring to. The reason that you can have a self-driving car is it can sense a lot about its environment. It can see what's happening. Look, that's a tree, that's a person, and can make decisions based upon that kind of sensory input. Now, there are so many jobs, so many industries, where all people are doing is acting as that sensory system and then engaging in some simple mechanical kind of thing, like, batting a hammer at a nail or taking a ticket at a station or carrying a bag or whatever it might be. And there are so many opportunities. Each one of those is a separate market and requires, typically today, a separate class of device. I have a wonderful video that I can't show on the radio showing robots that run around and space out plants at nurseries that grow millions of potted plants. And one of the most terrible jobs is these people, they employ thousands and thousands of people to do nothing but space out the plants as the plants grow so they can have enough room to grow. Well, now there's a wonderful little robot that can do this job and can do it 24 hours a day and doesn't get tired and doesn't get sick. And that's one example of an enormous array of human activities, so-called blue-collar jobs, which are going to be subject to this kind of automation. Since I got started by saying there were two innovations, the other one is in the area of machine learning. Now, I have to caution you, when you talk about machine learning, it has that anthropomorphic property. Oh, my God, if I can learn that, what else can it learn? That's really not what machine learning is about. What machine learning is about is, you can think of it as very sophisticated statistical analysis. You can feed in lots and lots of data, and it's capable of teasing out patterns that are very, very subtle, and that often cases people are incapable of doing, incapable of perceiving because of the nature of the data. So there's a whole other set of typically human activities from medical diagnosis to certain kinds of things that happen in the legal profession that will be impacted by this particular innovation in technology. So the future is very bright. The problem is that a lot of these jobs, as we know them today, are going to go away. And we need to be thinking about how do we distribute the benefits, the economic benefits that those forms of automation will bring much more broadly across society, and what do we do with those 3 million drivers that may be put out of a job and maybe aren't so skilled at doing social media promotion for restaurants.
You've got a really interesting solution in the final chapter, and I wrote that up for Forbes. Talk a little bit about how you avoid a world where There's incredible productivity by machines and a handful of people at the top of the ladder, and everyone else is out of work.
Well, the fundamental problem, which is really what the book is about, is explaining these technologies and then explaining that they make two societal problems worse. The first one is the rate of transformation in what constitutes valuable employment. There's the job markets. We're going to be putting a lot of people out of work. That doesn't mean there will be no work, but it means that the skills that we're going to need for that work are going to be different in the future. So we need to have much better ways to deal with that problem, and I do talk about this in the book, about, and you've also, I think, written about some of this stuff as well, about ways in which we're going to finance the retraining of the workforce in much more humane ways than we do today. The other, which I think you're referring to, is, I really meant this as an example, not as the solution. In fact, it was just the style of solution. The problem is, when we start when we talk about automation, when we talk about artificial intelligence applying to jobs and taking over certain kinds of tasks, what we're really talking about is just plain old automation. Automation is accelerating. And automation is the substitution of capital for labor. And the problem with that is that the people who benefit from it are those that have the capital. And the people who are going to get wealthy out of this are not the working public. It's going to be the people right here in Silicon Valley and other places like this that have the money to buy the robots and develop the technologies and apply them and to, as they say, disrupt industry after industry. So that is going to make the other social problem that we have, which is income inequality, significantly worse. Income inequality in the United States today is a national disgrace. It is on a level here at what it is in India and in Russia, although we don't tend to see it that way. When you put it in that context, I think we have a social problem that we really have to deal with. So I'm coming to the answer to your question. Sorry to be so long-winded.
The build-up's important.
Okay. The question is, we're going to have a great deal of additional wealth that's going to be created by this wave of automation. The question is, who's going to get it? And how do we make sure that it's distributed in a socially equitable way? So one of the ideas that I had in the book was to make a progressive, make the corporate tax progressive, so that companies whose stock is owned very broadly and therefore is benefiting a larger group of people than closely held companies pay a lower tax rate than those that are closely held. Now, the result of that would be to give advantages in the marketplace and reasons for companies to make sure that the benefits of the economic benefits that they're creating are much more widely distributed. So we don't need to steal from the rich and give to the poor. What we need to do is to change some of the economic guidelines and policies and rules that we have in order to align our economic policies more closely with the social goals that I think most of us share.
Nice. We've got time for questions. I know a lot of people here. I can know. I turn it over to you for a sec.
Thank you. Our thanks to Jerry Kaplan and George Anders in sharing their ideas with us on the future of artificial intelligence. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor for questions. Please keep your questions short. If you have a question, please raise your hand and I will bring the mic over to you. We are recording.
You said that the early people in artificial intelligence were just early, that made a bunch of predictions that eventually are coming true. What are the predictions that people are making about robots today that then maybe we might expect will come true in 20 years instead of 5?
Well, let's start with the basics. Let's just take the self-driving car. It's a wonderful technology. Some people have ridden in them. I have. I have a friend who has a unique distinction of having been probably the only person to have been in 2 accidents in a self-driving car. but the question is, self-driving cars, they're going to start with certain kinds of uses of those cars, which is like on the highway driving. Now, you might think highway driving is harder than local driving. It's not. It's the other way around. Being able to get a car that can act in socially appropriate ways in traffic is in local traffic is a much more difficult problem than the highway driving. So when people say, well, in 5 years, or I forgot exactly what the figure you used in your question, we're going to have self-driving cars, not really quite true. It might be 20 or 30 years before it will really be the case that unless we change our infrastructure, which is always possible, that a car is simply going to come and pick you up and take you somewhere in a reasonably reliable way. One of the kinds of problems that come up, how do you make eye contact with the driver of a driverless car to let them know whether it's okay for you to cross the street? These are the kinds of things. You pull up behind a UPS truck, which is stopped. Now, people know it's okay to cross over a yellow line and go around that truck, but when is it okay for your autonomous vehicle to do that, for your self-driving car? These are questions that we really haven't solved in an effective way, and I think that we're slightly overhyping this particular technology. So that's an example as an answer to your question.
Does that leave us in a place very similar to speech recognition, that it's possible to come up with something that does 80 to 90% of what people do, and then the last 10 to 20% turns out to be devilish? And
that's right. It's the last mile is going to be very, very difficult. On the other hand, there are great benefits to it, and we can change our infrastructure a bit to take advantage of it. One of the interesting things that I recently discovered is when cars were introduced, particularly in New York City, they disrupted the social patterns of how people interacted, and there was a big fight. There was a lot of social backlash to get the cars off the streets. I think we're going to see a lot of ban the bot stuff going on, and tremendous, be like the GM, no GMO movement, and we're going to have a lot of societal issues to deal with.
Yes. Will artificial intelligence ever get creative in the slightest way? When and how?
Okay. Well, I got good news and I have bad news on that question. Let me start with the bad news, because the bad news is very interesting. Just as I said earlier, that many of the tasks that computers can provide or can perform are tasks that you normally would think of as requiring human intelligence or attention. Let's just start with the most basic one. Adding up numbers, doing arithmetic. That used to be a specialist that was required to do that. You had to be intelligent. You had to be smart. You had to be careful and detailed. Now you can have a machine do it. We don't think of the machine as being intelligent, but that's the case. So the truth is that the kinds of tasks that we think of as creative, many of them are subject to automation using a different set of techniques, and the results appear similar to the creative results. So examples are things like writing press releases. I'm trying to pull an example or two. Or writing music. There are computer programs that write music, seemingly beautiful music. And I see no reason that can't happen in the future. I look forward to the time when the number one hit in the U.S. was written by a machine, because it will be better able to extract out the sorts of things that make a song popular than a human songwriter. That said, I don't think it's accurate to say that the machine is being creative. I'm merely saying that there are certain kinds of tasks that today we think require creativity that machines will be able to solve in ways that people will find indistinguishable from the activities of a creative person. Now, I should mention, you can't see this on the radio, but there is a beautiful Steinway piano right in front of me. I'm a jazz piano player. And I am not worried about a machine taking over that job, because who wants to hear a computer play the piano? Well, it's an example of a job that I think is, in some sense, automation-proof.
And, in fact, we had player pianos a century ago, and they have no more popularity now than they did then, mm-hmm. if anything, much less.
That's correct, Mr. Vonnegut.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
For the purpose of tonight, would you define what you mean by intelligence operatively in terms of this talk?
It's such a good question that I'm going to tell you my point of view, which is we don't really, intelligence is not a measurable linear quantity. We have a fascination as a culture with things that can be reduced to numbers and that can be ranked and rated and compared. Intelligence is more like beauty, or let's say being handsome. Let me state this in a way so my wife isn't going to accuse me of being sexist after I get done. Who's better looking, Keanu Reeves or Brad Pitt? Well, it's not a meaningless question, and a lot of people would be happy to answer that question. But is it meaningful to say that one of them is 7.34% more attractive than the other one? I don't think that's a meaningful statement. And I'm coming around to explaining about intelligence, but if you start to think about that ranking, that's where this whole idea of the singularity and the idea that machines might become more intelligent than people comes from. Well, my God, if one person can be 10% more attractive than another and a machine can be put on that scale, what happens when they become more attractive than the most attractive man? Women will never want to see men again. That's kind of the singularity argument put into that domain. My point is, intelligence is not a measurable quantity, and our fascination with things like IQ and, you know, Johnny's smarter than Mary, maybe Mary's very good at piano, and maybe Johnny's a great baseball player. All of these are forms of human intelligence. It comes in many different forms. So I can't define it. That's my point. And the whole notion and the term artificial intelligence has led us astray in understanding the real societal problems that we're going to have as a result of the work that's going on in the field.
Do you think it will be possible to, at some point, to make organic machines with bioengineering or genetic engineering so they're not just mechanical systems, but they're actually organic, maybe not alive, but could mimic some of the functions of life in thought and creativity?
I think the short answer is yes. There's a whole subculture, I will call it, in among the thinkers in this area called transhumanism, which has to do with the idea that you will begin to substitute mechanical elements, it's the other way around, for biological elements, but they could flip the other way as well. What does it mean when we have some kind of a, what's the term, chimera or a hybrid? Have I got the, George is my muse when it comes to words, he's amazing. There could be something like that. But fundamentally, when we ask the question, there's always an underlying question, which is, well, if we did have such a thing, what would it mean? And by that, I think we mean that. Does it deserve the courtesy of our empathy? Do we consider it to have rights? Do we think of it as having some status other than a resource which exists solely for us to use? And I don't really know the answer to that. I think that, you know, 100 years, 200 years from now, when there are devices walking around that have biological brains in them, if you will, I'm not sure how people will regard and try to answer that question. The only thing is, I'm glad I'm not going to be around to see it.
Hey, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
Question comes in regards to the economics of going to AI, robots, versus human labor. For example, you mentioned the self-driving car. If the population or the labor is cheap enough for me to employ somebody to drive my car for me, how does that affect the progression of AI, i.e., AI, i.e., the the progression of the self-driving car? If it's cheap enough for me, why would I ever progress into that world?
Well, to George's point, what if you had a venture fund and you were going to invest in these things? Well, some of them, it's going to be much more cost-effective to automate, and others, it will not be. And as the costs of technology change and the technology improves, more and more things become subject to automation. This is the history of automation in our culture. So I think we just need to recognize that this is nothing new in some sense. We are, I believe, as I've explained in my book, going to experience an acceleration of this particular issue, but it's not new. We simply look at it economically. Should we have a machine or a person? Now, as you may know, I mean, I've been a manager. I've run a number of companies, and we often had this question: should we invest in new technology, or should we hire some more people to do that? And we look at the question, and I think it was in what movie? I forgot the name of the movie, but somebody here in the audience will help me. The answer is sure. Let's give them a fair trial and then we'll hang them. The truth is it always made sense to automate. If you had the capital, it always made sense to automate. So I think that particularly as I look to the next 10 or 20 years, a whole range of activities that currently the only way to get it done is to hire some guy or person to go do it, we're going to find that it's going to be much more cost effective to have a machine do that particular job.
The
one thing I was going to interject, this will get solved differently in different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. I spent some time in India in the spring, and they e-commerce companies there have no interest in drones because at Indian wage levels, you can get packages delivered for 80 cents, and it's hard to make a drone beat that. So, but in higher wage countries like the U.S., I think Jerry's right, that the pull toward automation will be relentless.
My question is actually related to what you just said and what he just said in terms of we see a lot of third world countries in terms of their development kind of leapfrogging traditional Western levels of development. So as the Western world perfects and develops these automated systems for continents like Africa, which have emerging populations of very young people, are they going to suffer some type of labor crisis as they're then able to import these Western technologies that make their youthful demographics essentially irrelevant?
I think... maybe, but I think the answer may be the other way around. Those places have two advantages over us. The first is backward compatibility. We have systems in place today that they may not have in place, and they can leapfrog us by using new technologies rather than trying to figure out how to graft them onto existing technologies. An obvious example is we are now mining the copper out of our streets. We used from all the telephone lines that were laid down around the country. In places in Africa, they're never ever going to do that. They just start with the cell phone. So they don't incur that kind of an expense. So even self-driving cars, I'm talking about having them on the road with people, that's a very, very complicated and terrible thing. If you were starting from scratch, you would never design it that way. In fact, you'd never ever design it the way that we do it. I want to make one quick point about this. If I came to you today and we didn't have any cars and I said, hey, I got this great new thing. It's an automobile. Look at all the things you can do with it. You can go at 60 miles an hour. You can get from here to LA in 5 hours. You know, a whole raft of good stuff. There's just one catch. It's going to kill 30,000 people a year in the United States. Nobody would ever consider rolling something like that out. So as the expression goes, these technologies, we tend to boil the frog. You know, we don't realize how dangerous. And if we were starting de novo, we would never engage in those things. So one of the advantages is they can leapfrog us technologically. The second is if you have a young labor force like that, you can train them for whatever new kinds of jobs actually are going to emerge. It's a much more malleable resource than we typically have here in the U.S. today.
Well, we want to give our thanks to Jerry Kaplan and George Anders. We also want to thank the audience here as well as the listening audience. We are recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you.